You're listening to a podcast from 702.
702. Nola knows her knowledge is your power.
All right, Wendy Nola, before we even jump into consumer rights issues, who are you nominating non-political for president? We've had a couple of names, Tulima Donsela, MTS Suleiman, Patrice Motsepe, Vusi Tembekwayo, Bonang Mohale, Adrian Gore. had Chief Justice Mokgweng Mokgweng, DJs Boo. Who are you going to nominate? It can be anybody, but not a politician.
Okay, not a politician. I would have to add my vote to MTS Suleiman. I've been on 3 Gift of the Giffers missions with him. And I've seen very close up how he operates. And I think he would tick all the right boxes. So that's where my vote would go.
All right. So you also are saying MTS Suleiman, one of the listeners, because I was sharing with them some info that Gladys Modele of EWN shared with me, that he actually was on the ballot paper in 1994. Did you know that?
Really? I did not know that.
The ballot paper, and the party he was representing at the time was called Africa Muslim Party. And then he got a message or some sort of calling, if I could call it, that his purpose is to serve people in a different way, hence Gift of the Givers. Isn't that interesting?
And he certainly excelled at that. And yeah, I mean, in one of the missions, if not all of them, actually, you run into trouble with gaining access and all that kind of thing. Our plane had to land in a country, because we didn't have the right to fly over. I saw him liaising with the right people, the governments, to get us where we needed to be to do the right things. And so certainly, as I say, I have no hesitation in saying, yep, he'd be the man for the job. I doubt he'd want it, but
I need to correct myself. Dr. MTS Suleiman. And he did get asked when I interviewed him on The Upside of Failure, because somebody, I think, called in to say, would he run for president? And he said he definitely would not.
I'm not surprised.
Yes. And I think sometimes you can do better work from outside of the system than within the red tape and the politics and the dramas and the sagas. All right, let's jump into all of our things that we need to deal with regarding consumer rights issues. Let's start with our, how did Black Friday go? I have to be honest, I just forgot when the day happened. I didn't check any of my cards. I think the most I got was on my grocery app, Checker 6060 is like, oh, okay, you can get two of them. That's as far as Black Friday went.
Well, the last time I did Black Friday in an actual store was way before it came to this country. It was in Colorado, the States, where my sisters lived for many years. And it was back, I think, 2008. And that was the real Black Friday in the mall, mobs of people, extraordinary service throughout and huge savings. I've still got some of the stuff I bought on those sales. So that was that. And then when it came to this country, in the early days, I was always reporting about how the websites would fall over because I couldn't deal with the traffic. Do you remember that? Mm-hmm. That was always the big story. Anyway, so I've only ever done it online since that American experience. And then this year, I happened to take a week off, as you know, and I was in Munich, and I'd also forgotten. I was being a tourist in the center of Munich, going shopping, stuff I don't normally do, and suddenly on Friday, it was like, whoa, this is particularly busy today, and they were, okay, this is the actual Black Friday.
Yes.
They didn't actually call it Black Friday there. They called it Black Days, Black Week. The Friday word didn't happen a lot. I think it's acknowledging that things have moved on from that one particular day, but that one particular day, last Friday, was particularly insane in the shops.
Yes.
It was very cold and wet outside, so the shops were full. And I have to say, I didn't see any huge – the signs were – you didn't see anything sort of saying crazy 75% off or anything like that. I got 25% off a very nice woolen beanie, which I'll have to save for next winter. But, yeah, a very unusual experience. But meanwhile, while I was on very rare week's leave, my inbox was filling up with complaints and of all sorts of things. Typically Let's see now. Bargain buyers being cancelled by the retailer due to lack of stock. So the person bought it, so they thought, and then it was cancelled. Buyers not being able to contact the online retailer that they chose to buy from about returns due to bad fit or just not wanting it anymore. Sadly, then discovering when they wanted to take up their right to return something for no particular reason, bought online for within a 7-day thing. Suddenly, where's the contact details? Can't get hold of them. And then bargains being out of stock before orders were actually placed, and people saying, is this bait marketing? Why, you know, they put this advert out, it's Black Friday, how come I can't get this item? I just, before we go into an example of that, I wanted to just share a stat here, which I found quite alarming, and that was a payment facilitator, PayFast, which has massive traction. They ran a Black Friday dashboard tracking vital stats on the transactions that were going through, and they revealed that the top payment method preferred by most South African shoppers this year was instant EFTs, followed by credit card payments, Visa and MasterCard, and then MasterPass. And the majority of customers who paid with their orders using those instant EFT were Capitec, which of course has by far the largest number of bank customers in this country. And it's a little bit alarming for me because I understand not everyone qualifies for a credit card, although it's getting easier and easier to get one. So if you pay with a credit card, you have the benefit, as we keep saying on the show, of chargeback. So basically your bank speaks to the merchant's bank, and if you can prove you didn't get what you paid for, you get your money back. If you pay by EFT, there's no such protection. So just if you're going to regularly buy online and you go to buy from retailers that you haven't dealt with, that you hasn't got a solid track record, or you're not willing to actually do your homework and find out what their delivery performance is currently, and I stress the word currently, then you could lose your money, as many people have. So just a word of caution, if you're going to embrace online shopping, you might want to consider doing so with a credit card rather than via EFT.
So what I was actually sharing with the listeners earlier on, Wendy, was that I heard from somebody that the banks would actually have people that are working up until midnight standing by for people to apply for additional credit during Black Friday.
Okay.
So like as in hordes of people that are standing by at the credit department. So if a person suddenly decides, I need this TV, they can be able to process it in time.
Yeah, it's amazing where they throw staff at odd hours when it sort of suits them. Yes, sorry, just had to get that in. But opportunistic. And yeah, as we've been warning, that's, you know, it's advisable to use a credit card for online shopping, but the savvy way to do that would be to put money in beforehand, so you don't run up a huge credit balance that, if you're not, you know, that when you look at interest, especially if you default, is going to, you know, swallow up all those savings and more, and land you in a bad place, you know, in the new year with blacklistings and, you know, huge amounts to pay at best, etc. So, yeah, I'm sorry. I'm always the voice of doom, hey? The killjoy. Yes, but. Anyway, those are the realities, and the realities that I see in my inbox day in and day out. So, have to share.
Okay,
talking about sharing.
Yes.
Yeah. Clint wrote to me to say, this is a typical example of the kinds of post-Black Friday emails I get. I was so excited to shop for Black Friday specials. I came across a builder's advert for a gas fry. It was 6,490 Rand, which was a claimed saving of 5,500 Rand. So that would be massive in anyone's book, I suppose. And I called the shop about buying it, and I was told they had no stock. I then went back online to see if I could order it. It was not available to order, but they wanted me to contact the store to order from them. With going back and forth, no luck. I've called customer care several times, no luck. What is the best way forward for this? As I don't feel a company should advertise something they cannot supply at their 124 branches countrywide. I think it's a false advert. I should be able to buy the item as advertised. And he sent me the copies of the advert, which actually in small print say that the promotion is valid until the end of February 2023, which is interesting. So not just a Black Friday thing. So I got a hold of Massmart and asked a few questions around that. How many units were sold? You know, was the bra actually available both online and in stores? And are they comfortable that they provided enough units to satisfy the demand created by that advert, certainly at the time that it was running? Because I won't go into the details, but the CPA, the Consumer Protection Act, does have a section on bait marketing, which says that a supplier must not advertise any particular goods as being available at a specified price. That may result in consumers being misled or deceived in any respect relating to the actual availability of those goods. Okay. So Massmart responded and said perhaps the best way to respond would be to explain how we determine stock that will be available for sale promotions. And I thought this was worth sharing. Mm. Typically four steps, all of which were followed, Massmart says, in determining the stock available for sale over Black Friday. The steps are: identify in-store and online rate of sale based on previous promotional pricing and product demand for that particular item. If the proposed promotional price is significantly lower than previous promotions on the item, then add further stock. This makes sense, right? And uplift. This can be a complex calculation based on uplift we have previously seen in sales, based, for example, on uplift in demand for every 200 Rand decrease in price. The value will vary depending on product value. We identify the rate of sale by region and by store, and then we finalize our sales forecast, place the order, and allocate stock by store and for online sales. It does happen to his Massmart that despite our best efforts, that stock can sell through more quickly than we had forecast, or it might sell through very slowly. We did find that online sales demand was significant during Black Friday 2022. This was the result of a much improved online experience, better than we anticipated. It's also challenging to anticipate online demand given that we are still generating reliable demand history in the context that online adoption is relatively recent in South Africa. So he's basically saying, you know, it really took off during lockdown just 2 years ago. And so they haven't got much, a long thread of data to work on. And then he added, Builders is a reputable retailer and we absolutely do not engage in sharp practice to generate promotional sales. There is really no upside to doing this. I didn't get a word on how many units were sold, but when I shared that with Clint, he was like, no, I get that, but I'm still unhappy because if that promotion is going till the end of February, then
and you still
there should
don't
have been ample stock.
Exactly. I was going to say, did the stock that was put out till end of Feb run out?
Yeah, so I went, it was very valid questions. I went back to my high-level contact at Massmart, and he said all stock would typically not be delivered in a single delivery for a three-month promotion. My intuitive opinion, given the length of the promotion, is that this is likely a case of currently available stock being sold out as we await further online and store-specific replenishment from the supplier. It does make sense. There would be an awful lot of stuff for stores to and warehouses to stock 3 months' worth of a very well-priced bra. It's quite usual to receive deliveries from a supplier in tranches for promotions of this duration. He's going to follow up and see what he can do because that was quite last minute, quite shortly before we came on air. And so Clint is saying, I still want that bra, and I'm pretty sure we're going to be able to make a plan and get it to him. And for others who lost out on that particular item, the good news appears to be that there will be more stock coming in to satisfy the demand created by saying this is a three-month promotion. So there's still Christmas and, you know, January and February to come.
Look,
just an interesting little case, I thought.
Good on Clint, you know, obviously for chasing. Not many people have the patience to continuing to fight for that, like, specific discount for that bri, but also
it's
respect
a good one.
Yeah, to Massmart for explaining. It does make sense, and I think there's certain operational things that we may not be aware of as the public, that it might seem so simple to be like, why don't you just have stock or sitting in one place? And maybe it's not that simple, but for them at least to take the time to go and make an explanation. Let's take a quick break and then we continue with some of these Black Friday lessons.
So 702.
Nola knows.
26 minutes after 2 o'clock, we're still with Wendy Nola. Wendy, so let's jump straight into the next thing on our agenda.
Okay. So, it's about the right to well, I call them the right to repair guidelines. It's guidelines which the Competition Commission had promulgated. They came into effect in July last year. And they represent the biggest change to the way new cars are sold and maintained in South Africa. Essentially, the Commission believes that as motorists, we have the right to have our in-warranty cars serviced and repaired at a workshop other than the ones approved by the manufacturer, officially called the original equipment manufacturer or OEM. So be it Volkswagen, Nissan, BMW, whatever, without having our warranties invalidated, because that's always been the lock-in, right?
Mm.
The warranty is 3 years or 5 years or even 7 years in some cases. And if you dare have your car worked on, serviced, maintained by a workshop that's not within the dealership, the OEM network, then that's it. Warranty invalidated, cancelled. So this was a massive move away from that. And the gazetted guidelines also allow for the fitting of non-original parts, which you can imagine the traditional industry was not at all happy about.
Because they're going to lose out on the business.
Yeah, I guess so. They say, and with some merit, I suppose that, you know, the flip argument from the industry is that, you know, it's not in the interest of the consumer because those parts might not be the same quality.
Mm.
And the other big thing was that at the time the vehicle is sold, dealers and the financing banks must provide the consumer with details of all inclusions and exclusions in the service and maintenance plans, and they can't just be all bundled together. The whole thinking behind this was that the automotive sector, their conduct was anti-competitive, keeping, you know, the smaller players out and forcing consumers to, you know, as we said, go to their network, their chosen network, or else lose out on the warranty. The other thing was lack of access to technical information by these smaller players, small and medium-sized players, ISPs, as they're called, independent service providers. How do you operate if you can't get information, technical information on the vehicles? The Commission's guidelines say remove that obstacle, rather, and say that the OEMs must share key technical information with the smaller players for cars that are both in warranty and out of warranty. Of course, the OEMs fiercely resisted all these changes, saying that if they lost the ability to stipulate that their vehicles be serviced at particular quality assured dealerships that they monitored, consumers wouldn't have the assurance that staff at independent workshops would have the training and skills of their guys in the, and women in manufacturer-linked workshops, or that top quality parts would be used. So this week, the Competition Commission, which is why I'm talking about it, announced that it's embarking on a two-day roadshow, and they would be visiting automotive hubs and the workshops of those smaller players in Joburg, Pretoria, and surrounding areas, as well as those of East London and Mthatha in the Eastern Cape, to promote economic access, inclusion, and greater spread of ownership for historically disadvantaged individuals. So I thought I invited a Competition Commission spokesman, Karabo Botang, on to join us and talk about why this has happened. What are they, you know, it's almost 18 months now since we've had these guidelines in place. Mm. What effect have they had? How have they shaken up the industry or not?
So what we'll do, Wendy, Karabo is standing by. As soon as we come back from Eyewitness News headlines, then we'll jump straight into that conversation, because I think it is quite an important one that needs the adequate time. It's 2:30.
702.
Nola knows. Her knowledge is your power.
We're still with Wendy Nola. We take your calls on 011-883-0702 in the WhatsApp line 072-702-1702. Before we went to Eyewitness News, we were about to chat to Karabo Motaung from the Competition Commission on this issue that we're speaking about with regards to vehicles and the restrictions that may have been there with regards to manufacturers, parts, where you can take the vehicle. So welcome, Karabo. Thank you so much for waiting so patiently. Wendy, you can go ahead.
Thanks very much, Rebekile. Hello, Karabo. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Wendy. Hi, Lebogile. Thanks for having me.
Let's jump in then. The press release which the commission put out this week about the road shows, which the commission is doing in the Joburg and Pretoria areas and also in parts of East London, was said to be as a result of the commission receiving several complaints regarding practices perceived as unfair in the automotive aftermarket sector, including unbundling the sale of motor vehicles with value-added products. So my understanding that is the way that maintenance and service plans are sold. The appointment of service providers to panels by original equipment manufacturers, let's call them manufacturers, and insurers. So, you know, the insurers all have their panels. If you bash your car, you lodge the claim and they want you to go to certain people. That's considered to be anti-competitive. Voiding of manufacturer warranties, the big one, when consumers take their in-warranty vehicles to an independent service provider, and access to the manufacturer's technical information accessed by the smaller independents, and in other words, not be able to get that technical information. So in short, some industry defiance. We have to be careful. It's obviously not everywhere, but pockets of defiance to some of the most important provisions in those guidelines. So, Grabo, who is doing the complaining? Is it the small players, the small, medium-sized independent workshops? Is it consumers or both? And by your reckoning, how widespread is this problem of the guidelines being ignored?
Thanks, Wendy. So we've seen a large number of complaints coming in largely from the ISPs. And of course, raising some of the issues that you've already highlighted now, and some have come, you know, from consumers as well, you know, particularly as it relates to the unbundling, you know, of value-added products from the sale of the motor vehicles.
Okay, why don't you talk about that? Seeing as this is a consumer show, and you've highlighted that as generating a lot of complaints from consumers. What was supposed to happen after July the 1st when these guidelines were promulgated, and what, according to these complainants, is actually still happening?
So essentially, Wendy, following the issuing of the guidelines, a consumer should be able to buy a vehicle and decide whether or not they want to buy the value-added product with the motor vehicle. As a consumer has the right to decide that they want to buy the vehicle and not the service plan, and perhaps purchase a service plan somewhere else. So that's what was supposed to happen.
Okay.
Also, yeah, so that's from a consumer perspective, right?
Which is important, because if you've got a service plan, then of course that's part of the whole anti-competitive behavior, because you've paid for it now and you're not going to want to now go to a smaller workshop, which you're entitled to now without validating your warranty. But why would you incur double cost? So I can see that as being a problem. So when you take, presumably the commission then investigates, and when you approach the dealership or the manufacturer in question, what sort of response have you had to that anti-competitive behavior?
So we've had quite a mixed response, Wendy. We've had OEMs that we have been able to engage with and that have responded positively to our engagements. And so those OEMs, for example, we are not investigating further. There are those that are clearly unwilling to engage. They are not willing to comply with the guidelines. And so those complaints are currently sitting with the market conduct division for further investigation.
Okay. So overall, if you had to rate the OEM and their dealer network's response and compliance with the guidelines and as a mark out of 10, what would the mark be as we sit at the end of 2022?
Wendy, I would say perhaps a 4 out of 10.
Wow. Okay.
So it's not looking good at all.
Okay. What were you hoping for realistically in terms of level of compliance by now, if we're going to stick with our mark out of 10 measure?
Sure. I mean, it's almost a year, Wendy, and I think more than anything, you know, we were expecting to at least be sitting on a 5 or a 6, when it comes to this level of compliance.
Okay. So, knowledge is power, as we always say in this show. To what extent are things continuing as they always have? Because in some cases, neither the motorists, the consumers, or the smaller independents know about the guidelines and what their new rights are.
Indeed, Wendy, you know, and that's the purpose of the roadshow that the team has been undertaking the last 2 days, right, is more than anything to inform and raise awareness to these ISPs about the guidelines and what the guidelines mean for them. And what we've done throughout our visits, Wendy, is we've actually published a chart that will go up on the walls of in these workshops, right? And it also just states what these guidelines mean for consumers as well. So as a consumer, when you walk in there and you are able to read that document, you'll be able to understand what it means for you as a consumer. What are your rights when it comes to servicing of your vehicle, purchasing of your vehicle, and what does it mean when you talk about a warranty and when and how a warranty can and cannot be void by the OEMs, because that's one thing that is coming up a lot, Wendy, where OEMs are threatening or raising high concerns, you know, amongst customers that, you know what, if you get your vehicle repaired by an ISP and not by an OEM, you know, chances are that your warranty will be void. And that is not true, Wendy. That is completely not true, you know, and our consumers need to be aware that an OEM would actually need to conduct a full-on assessment on a vehicle and actually prove the fault, you know, before voiding any warranty. And the Consumer Protection Act clearly states that, and consumers are properly protected when it comes to that. So the Competition Act does not regulate that part, Wendy, but we in our guidelines, more than anything, we are re-emphasizing it so that consumers are aware of their rights when it comes to that.
Okay. I want to just canvass something that I think will be in the minds of a lot of motoring listeners and possibly, you know, planted there by the industry itself, and that is that they don't trust an independent workshop, whether or not they warranties would be invalidated. They don't trust an independent workshop to have the skills to do a proper job on their car, especially given that the Commission has revealed that some industry players, OEMs, have been reluctant to share these skills, even though the smaller guys are willing and able to pay for the transferring of such knowledge. What would you say to counter that consumer perception where it exists, and also just address the questions of what's being done in the case of those OEMs that aren't playing ball and that aren't willing to share that technical knowledge as required by the guidelines?
Sure. Thanks, Wendy. So essentially, those OEMs, like I said, you know, that are not willing to comply, complainants are coming forward and they are informing us. And so, like I said, we are willing to engage. However, those that are not willing to engage, essentially, we are having to, we are investigating, and depending on what the outcomes of that investigation is, the Commission will then proceed with prosecution. Wendy, I missed your, I forgot your first part of the question, Wendy.
Bad to give you a two-parter. It was about consumer perception in some quarters that they can't trust the skills of the smaller independents. They can't trust them to do a proper job on their car.
Wendy, you know, when we talk about ISPs, from the Commission's perspective, the people that we are trying to open the market up for, we're talking about ISPs that are registered, ISPs that are accredited, ISPs that are approved to do work on motor vehicles. So these workshops have trained technicians, Wendy, so they can definitely be trusted. You know, I mean, the fact that they are accredited means that they can do the work, you know, and there's absolutely no way that we would advocate for ISPs that are not accredited. So I think consumers must trust, of course, they must do their due diligence as well, you know, to make sure that the ISP that they are going to is accredited and registered with the with the relevant industry bodies, Wendy.
Okay. Just if you wouldn't mind staying on the line, just for the purpose of balance, I ran the Commission's comments past Mark Demisa, who's the National Chairman of the National Automobile Dealers Association, better known as NADA. Now, these dealerships obviously work in tandem and have agreements, contractual agreements with the OEMs, the manufacturers. He says, we as NADA have worked very hard with the Competition Commission on the guidelines and continue to work with them in a positive communicative fashion. In September, we had a positive engagement with the Commission to discuss the effect of the guidelines 1 year on. During the meeting, the Commission presented us with statistics for the period 1st of July 2021, this is when the guidelines came into effect, to the 1st of September this year, noting 30 complaints received, of which 15 had been resolved at that time. Of the 30 complaints received, only two related to access to technical information from the OEM, from an independent, and both of those had been resolved to the satisfaction of the Commission. Based on the above and our own internal data at NADA, we are not seeing an access to technical information issue. We must, however, note that as the technical data is the intellectual property of the manufacturer and therefore only for the manufacturer to provide, NADA members as franchise dealers are not able to assist ISPs with technical data and can only refer the ISP to the OEM, and each of them have their own process for the independents to access information. They should be contacted directly, not the dealerships. Of course, you know, he didn't respond to the allegations in some cases of the dealerships stating to consumers that, you know, if they get there, because the consumer mostly deals with the dealerships, not the manufacturer. That's where you engage, you take your car to a dealership. You don't drive to the manufacturer's head office. And, you know, Garaba, as you've said, there are those that have blatantly said if you take your car elsewhere, your warranty will be invalidated. No comment on that. But yeah, your response to that, Garaba, what are your thoughts on that response? Because he's saying there's no problem, we're cooperating.
Wendy, I mean, like I said, you know, there are people or OEMs that are cooperating, but like I said, it's not all of them. You know, I mean, if you look at the list of complaints that we have, you know, it's the OEMs that are here, it's all the big guys, you know, and I mean, the complaints are quite varied, you know, between the OEMs themselves. And indeed, Wendy, I think I would agree with the last point that he's made there, that the ISPs would have to go to the OEM, right, in respect of requesting
technical,
access, for example, to technical information. However, information such as records of the vehicle, Wendy, this is information that the dealerships would have, right? And so it is the dealerships in that aspect that would then have to provide the ISP with the records of the motor vehicle. But with regards to technical training, technical aspects of it, I agree with the fact that the ISP would need to approach the OEM directly.
Okay. Lastly, a consumer who's thinks they've been getting incorrect information or has any other, you know, takes the car to someone that they know and trust, and independent says, sorry, we can't help because this particular car, this particular model, we don't have the information, or we can't access parts or whatever. Mm-hmm. Can they come to the Commission, lodge a complaint? Will the Commission take it up? Is there that avenue available for consumers?
Definitely, Wendy. Consumers, ISPs, anyone with information of any anti-competitive conduct that is happening in that space is welcome to lodge a complaint with the Competition Commission. We've got a form CC1 that is on our website, and then our numbers are also there, so they are more than welcome to lodge complaints, Wendy.
Okay, brilliant. And please email me a copy of that notice that's going up. I'll be very happy to share that on my socials and get the message out.
Okay, will do. Thanks, Wendy.
Thanks, Garaba.
Thank you so much, Garaba. Okay, let's quickly go to the calls with the little time we do have left. We've got Prosperous in Johannesburg South. Prosperous, go ahead.
Hello, are you? I wanted to find out from Wendy. Wendy, it happened, the thing I am talking about happened on the 19th of August. I went to one of the repeated garages to sort of like get petrol for my vehicle. Unfortunately, they put diesel in the car. And then after that was said and done, after driving for less than a kilometer, then the car stalled. So I didn't know what was happening with the car. So I phoned that friend of mine to come and help me. When he came through, he asked for my slip. I showed him the slip. The slip was written diesel. So now I went back to the garage to tell them, guys, check what you did. You put diesel in the car to the petrol. They said they don't have anyone to sort of like tow the car to the garage with. So I had to ask a friend to help me to tow the car to the garage. When I got there, when the guy was busy actually removing the rope that he used to tow the vehicle, the manager for the garage actually saw what the writing that was written on the guy's vehicle. And then he went to approach him so that he can actually help to drain the diesel, since they didn't actually even have a mechanic to do that. So after doing all that, then they put the corrupt petrol in the car. So I had to drive 15 kilometers into the freeway. The vehicle caught fire and it was burnt to ashes.
What?
So what I did, I then went back to the garage. That was, it happened on a Friday. I went to the garage on Saturday. I spoke to the manager. The manager said, you know, there's not that we can do. The person that actually did your vehicle, we spoke to him. He did a good job. After that, I took it upon the insurance, because they gave me the details of the insurance to talk with the insurance. Since I'm a fed back into the claim, then the insurance sent an assessor to come and assess the damage on the vehicle, since the vehicle was written off, actually it was burnt to ashes.
Wow.
Then, according to the assessor said the mechanic that drained the diesel did not do a proper job.
Yeah.
Then I said to him, he didn't do a proper job. I didn't appoint him to work on my vehicle. And on that particular day, you know, I had to transfer to my vehicle just because I was supposed to do some other jobs besides that. So I had no time to sort of like even to rethink of whatever was happening there, as they appointed the guy to come and work on the vehicle. So they actually sent me from pillar to post. Until today, they told me, they sent me an email, that just because the mechanic that actually worked on the vehicle was not qualified to do that. But the mechanic, after which the mechanic wrote an invoice, that they are claiming the diesel from the vehicle. And then they
okay.
Say,
so, Prosperous, can I just come in here? This is quite a big one that will probably need a lengthy response. And unfortunately, we've run out of time. So we're going to take it offline with Wendy. But what I would advise to all of the listeners, if you find yourselves in a situation where the wrong fuel is poured into your vehicle, call the car manufacturer to say, what am I supposed to do if diesel was poured into this vehicle? Do not let anybody touch your vehicle. Do not let anybody. And maybe that's something we can address on the car feature. But unfortunately, we have run out of time. And apologies, Tebogo, we didn't get an opportunity to take your call. We'll be back with Wendy next week.